The night Rose Ashworth walked into the Duke of Ravenswood's ball, every whisper in the room carried the same word. Thief. She had heard it before in market squares, in church pews, in the careful silence of people who looked away when she passed. She had learned to keep her chin up and her eyes forward. She had learned not to flinch. But this was different. This was the most powerful room in England. And somewhere inside it, standing among the candlelight and the pearls and the rustling silk, was the Duke himself. What no one in that room understood, not the women behind their fans, not the men with their cold stares, not even Rose herself, was that the real theft had happened years ago. And tonight, finally, the truth was going to come out. It had started 3 days earlier with a letter. Rose had found it by accident. She had been in the hallway of the cramped Ashworth house, a house that had once been grand, that still had high ceilings and wide windows, but now felt like a coat two sizes too small, when she heard her stepmother's voice coming from the parlor. Lady Vivienne was speaking quietly. That alone was unusual. Vivienne was not a quiet woman. She was silk and sharp edges, always filling a room with her perfume and her opinions. When she spoke quietly, it meant something was wrong. Rose had stopped walking. It came addressed to her, Vivienne was saying, which makes no sense whatsoever. Why would the Duke of Ravenswood invite Rose? A pause, then Cecily's voice softer, younger, a little uncertain. Perhaps Father knew him before he died. Your father knew everyone and left us nothing, Vivienne said. What matters is that this invitation exists, and we are not going to waste it on a girl who spends her afternoons mending her own stockings. Rose had pressed herself against the wall. An invitation from the Duke of Ravenswood. She had never met the man. She had never even been to London before her father died. The Ashworth family had lived quietly in the country, and after the funeral they had lived even more quietly, because Vivienne had made sure of it. Slowly, carefully, piece by piece, everything that had belonged to Rose's father had been absorbed into Vivienne's household. The silver, the horses, the small collection of jewelry that Rose's mother had left behind. Rose had not fought it, she had not known how. But this was something else. She waited until the parlor was empty. Then she walked in, opened the writing desk drawer where Vivienne kept everything she wanted to disappear, and took the letter. It was cream-colored, heavy paper. The seal had already been broken, inside in clean, dark ink. Miss Rose Ashworth is cordially invited to attend the autumn ball at Ravenswood House, London. The Duke requests the pleasure of her company. The Duke requests. Not Cecily, not Lady Vivienne, Rose. She read it 3 times. Then she folded it carefully, tucked it into the lining of her coat, and went upstairs to find the only decent dress she still owned. She arrived in London on a gray afternoon with a small bag and enough money for 2 nights at a modest inn. She told no one. She left no note. For the first time in 4 years, she did something entirely for herself. The night of the ball, she dressed alone in a small room with a cracked mirror. Her gown was pale blue, not fashionable, not trimmed with anything but clean and well-fitted. Her hair she pinned herself, simply, the way her mother had taught her. She had no pearls, no jewels, nothing that caught the light. She looked at herself in the mirror for a long moment. Then she picked up her gloves, walked out the door, and got into the carriage she had hired with the last of her money. When she stepped into Ravenswood House and gave her name to the majordomo, she expected confusion. She expected to be turned away, or questioned, or quietly redirected to some mistake. Instead, the majordomo looked at his list, found her name immediately, and said, "Miss Ashworth, we have been expecting you." Rose went very still. Expecting her. She stepped into the ballroom, and the whispers began. The ballroom was everything Rose had ever imagined, and nothing she had been prepared for. Ravenswood House was not merely grand. It was the kind of grand that made you feel the weight of your own smallness, ceilings that soared into shadow, chandeliers that held more candles than Rose had seen in a year, walls lined with portraits of men who had all died important. The floor was pale marble, cold and perfect. The women moved across it like ships under full sail, their gowns sweeping behind them in shades of gold and ivory and deep crimson. Rose stood at the entrance in her pale blue dress and felt every single eye in the room find her at once. She had expected to be invisible. She had not expected this. The whispers started at the edges and moved inward, fast and quiet, the way fire moves through dry grass. She could not hear the words, "not yet," but she did not need to. She had heard that particular sound before. The sound of a room deciding something about you before you have taken a single step. She lifted her chin. She walked forward. It was then that she saw Vivienne. Her stepmother was standing near the far wall beside Cecily, dressed in deep green silk, a diamond brooch at her throat that Rose recognized immediately. It had belonged to Rose's mother. Rose had last seen it in her mother's jewelry box, the morning after her father's funeral, before Vivienne had quietly moved everything into her own rooms. Vivienne saw Rose at the exact same moment. The color drained from her face. Not surprise, not confusion. Fear. Rose filed that away carefully and kept walking. She took a glass of lemonade from a passing tray because her hands needed something to hold. She stood near a window and tried to look as though she belonged, as though she attended balls in London regularly, as though her heart was not beating entirely too fast inside her chest. It was from that position that she first saw the Duke. James Mercer, Duke of Ravenswood, was not what she had expected. She had imagined someone older, colder, the kind of man who existed in portraits and legal documents and nowhere else. But he was perhaps 35, dark-haired, with the kind of stillness about him that powerful men sometimes had. Not arrogance, exactly. More like a man who had long ago stopped needing to prove anything to anyone. He was standing with a small group near the center of the room, speaking quietly to another gentleman, when he looked up. And he looked directly at Rose. Not in the way the others had looked at her, not with that cool, measuring social glance that dismissed and categorized in a single second. He looked at her the way a man looks at something he has been searching for and has finally found. Rose felt the hair rise on the back of her neck. She looked away first. She was not sure why. Behind her, she heard the sound of silk moving quickly across marble. Then Vivienne's perfume reached her, roses and something sharper underneath. And her stepmother was suddenly at her elbow, her voice low and furious and perfectly controlled. "What are you doing here?" It was not a question. "I was invited," Rose said quietly. "That invitation was not for you to use." "It had my name on it." Vivienne's grip tightened on her small evening bag. Her eyes moved quickly across the room, calculating, as they always were, and then she leaned closer. "You will leave," she said, quietly and without making a scene, "and tomorrow we will discuss what happens to girls who take things that do not belong to them." The words landed exactly as they were intended to. Rose felt them in her chest, in that old familiar place where 4 years of silence had settled like stone. Girls who take things that do not belong to them. She opened her mouth to respond. She did not yet know with what, when the room shifted around her. A hush moved through the ballroom. Not the sharp silence of scandal, but the particular, instinctive quiet that falls when the most important person in the room begins to move. Rose turned. The Duke of Ravenswood was walking toward her. Vivienne went absolutely rigid beside her. He stopped in front of Rose. Up close, His eyes were darker than she had expected, and there was something in them she could not immediately name. He did not look at Vivienne. He did not acknowledge her at all. He looked only at Rose. Then he bowed slightly, correctly, formally, and said, in a voice calm enough to carry to every ear straining in their direction, "Miss Ashworth, I am very glad you came." The whispers exploded. Rose heard her own voice come out steadier than she felt. "Your Grace." He extended his hand. "May I have this dance?" Behind her, she could feel Vivienne's fury like heat from an open flame. Around her, she could feel the entire room watching, fans paused mid-flutter, conversations abandoned mid-sentence. Rose looked at his outstretched hand. She thought about the letter with her name on it. She thought about the majordomo who had said, "We have been expecting you." She thought about the fear on Vivienne's face the moment she had walked through the door. She thought about 4 years of keeping her chin up and her eyes forward. Then she placed her hand in his. "You may," she said. And the Duke of Ravenswood led the thief's daughter onto the floor, in front of everyone, as though it were the most natural thing in the world. The music was a waltz. Rose had not danced in 4 years. Not since before her father's illness, before the funeral, before Vivienne had quietly dismantled everything that the Ashworth name had once meant. But her body remembered. Her mother had made sure of that hours of practice in the drawing room of their old house, the one with the yellow curtains and the view of the garden, back when there had still been a garden to look at. She did not stumble. She was grateful for that, at least. The Duke danced well. He led without forcing, which she appreciated. He gave her enough space to find her footing, and he did not fill the silence immediately, which she appreciated even more. He simply danced and let her settle and watched her with those dark, unreadable eyes. Around them, the other couples moved and turned, but Rose was aware that half of them were watching her instead of their own partners. She kept her eyes forward. It was the Duke who spoke first. "You came alone," he said. "It was not a question."
"Yes."
"From the country?"
"Yes."
A pause, then very quietly, "Was it difficult getting here?" Rose considered the question. She thought about the letter hidden in her coat lining. She thought about the hired carriage and the cracked mirror and the last of her money. "A little," she said. Something moved in his expression. Not pity, she would have closed off immediately at pity. Something more like recognition. They turned at the edge of the floor. Rose caught a glimpse of Vivienne near the wall, standing very still, watching them with an expression that Rose had never seen on her face before. Vivienne was a woman who always knew what to do next. At this moment, she appeared to have no idea. Good, Rose thought, and then felt guilty for thinking it. The Duke spoke again, lower this time. "Lady Vivienne has been speaking to several guests this evening, before you arrived and since." Rose's stomach tightened. "About me?"
"Yes."
"What did she say?" He was quiet for a moment, not evasive, more as though he was choosing his words with some care. "That some years ago, a piece of jewelry went missing from the Ashworth household, a ruby brooch, that you were the only one with access to it, that your father, in his grief over your mother's death, refused to believe it of you, but that the brooch was never found." Rose heard the words as though from a distance. She had not known about the brooch specifically. She had known that Vivienne had told people things. She had seen it in their faces, in the way certain families in the village had stopped including her, in the way invitations had quietly ceased arriving. But she had never known exactly what story Vivienne had built. She had been too busy surviving inside it to examine its shape from the outside. A ruby brooch. She almost laughed. It was so specific, so carefully chosen. A missing jewel, an absent father too heartbroken to press charges, a stepdaughter with no one to speak for her. It was, she had to admit, an elegant lie. Miss Ashworth, the Duke's voice was careful, precise. Did you take it? She met his eyes directly. No, she said. He held her gaze for a moment. The music turned around them. I know, he said. Rose missed a step. He steadied her, barely, one slight adjustment of his hand at her waist, and they continued as though nothing had happened. But Rose's mind had stopped entirely. I know. Not I believe you, not I want to believe you. I know. How, she said. The word came out before she could stop it. Your father wrote to me, the Duke said, 8 months before he died. The music continued. The candles continued. The room continued to turn and whisper and watch. Rose felt as though the floor had shifted slightly beneath her feet, as though the entire ballroom had tilted 2 degrees to the left and had not yet tilted back. My father, she repeated. We were friends, a long time ago, before your mother, before mine. We lost touch, as men do. He found me again when he became ill. A brief pause. He was frightened, Miss Ashworth, not of dying, of what would happen after. Rose thought of her father in his last months, thinner than he should have been, quieter than she had ever known him, sitting by the window of his bedroom and looking out at the grounds with an expression she had not been able to read at the time. She understood it now. He had been doing the arithmetic. He had seen exactly what was coming and had not known how to stop it. He had written to the Duke of Ravenswood. What did he say? She asked. Her voice was very steady. She was rather proud of it. Everything, the Duke said simply. He said everything. The waltz was ending. Rose could feel it in the music, the slight slowing, the final measures approaching. In a moment they would stop and she would have to let go of his hand and the room would close back in around her. Why didn't you come sooner? She said. She had not meant it to sound like an accusation. She was not entirely sure it wasn't one. The Duke was quiet for 3 full seconds. I tried to find you, he said. You were not where your father's letter said you would be. You were not where anyone said you would be. Something shifted in his voice, something that sounded unexpectedly like anger, not at her. Lady Vivienne is very good at making things difficult to find. The music stopped. They stood still in the center of the floor. Around them, couples separated and applauded politely and drifted toward the edges of the room. Rose and the Duke stood where they were for 1 moment longer than was strictly proper. Rose became aware in that moment that Vivienne was moving. She was crossing the room with purpose, straight toward the Duke, her green silk cutting through the crowd like a blade, her expression rebuilt into something smooth and social and dangerous. Beside her, Cecily followed with her eyes down, looking as though she wished very much to be somewhere else entirely. Rose watched her stepmother come. She thought about 4 years. She thought about the brooch that had never existed and the story that had been built around it, and the silence she had lived inside while that story spread and settled and became, to everyone who heard it, simply the truth. The Duke had not moved away from her side. She thought about that too. Vivienne reached them. Her smile was perfect. Her eyes were not. Your Grace, she said warmly, as though she had not just spent 20 minutes poisoning every ear in the room. I hope my stepdaughter has not been troubling you. She has always had a tendency to place herself where she is not quite expected. The Duke looked at Vivienne. He said nothing for a moment, just looked at her with that particular stillness of his, the stillness of a man who has already decided something and is simply waiting for the right moment to say it. When he spoke, his voice was perfectly pleasant. On the contrary, Lady Vivienne, he said, Miss Ashworth is precisely where I intended her to be. Vivienne's smile did not move, but something behind her eyes did. And Rose, standing in the center of the most powerful ballroom in England in her pale blue dress with her simply pinned hair, felt something shift inside her chest, something that had been locked tight for 4 years, something she had stopped expecting to ever move again. It felt, very tentatively and very carefully, like hope. The supper room was quieter than the ballroom, lit with fewer candles and furnished with the kind of careful elegance that suggested comfort without quite achieving it. Long tables ran the length of the room, set with white linen and silver that caught the light. Guests moved through in small clusters, plates in hand, voices lower here than they had been on the dance floor. The Duke had guided Rose toward it after the waltz ended, not forcefully, not with any particular drama, simply with a slight inclination of his head and a quiet, "Miss Ashworth, would you do me the honor?" And she had followed because she did not yet know what else to do with the things he had told her. "Your father wrote to me. He said everything." Everything. She kept turning that word over in her mind like a stone she had found on a path, examining it from every angle, not yet certain whether it was ordinary or extraordinary. They sat at a small table near the window, slightly apart from the larger groups. A footman brought wine. The Duke waited until the footman had gone before he spoke. "I imagine you have questions," he said. "Several hundred," Rose said. "I am trying to decide which one to ask first." Something moved at the corner of his mouth. Not quite a smile, but the suggestion of one. "Take your time." Rose looked at her wine glass. Outside the window, London was dark and scattered with lights, carriages moving below on the street, the sounds of the city muffled by glass and distance. It struck her, suddenly and with unexpected force, that she had not sat in a room like this, warm and lit and full of food and people who were not looking at her with suspicion, in a very long time. She pushed the thought away. There would be time for that later. "The letter," she said, "my father's letter. You said he wrote to you 8 months before he died. What exactly did he say about Vivienne?" The Duke set down his own glass. He was quiet for a moment, and she had the sense that he was not organizing his thoughts so much as deciding how much of them to share at once, and in what order, the way a careful person handles something fragile. "He said that he had made a mistake," the Duke began. "That in his grief after your mother's death he had been, his word was asterisk foolish. He had not seen Vivienne clearly. He had seen someone who was capable and composed and who seemed to want nothing more than to care for his household and his daughter." A pause. "He understood, by the time he wrote to me, that he had confused capability with goodness, that he had let someone into your life who did not deserve to be there." Rose said nothing. She was looking at the table. "He had discovered by then what Vivienne had done with your mother's jewelry. Not just the brooch, that was the story she invented for the village, the one she used to explain why certain pieces had disappeared. In reality, she had been selling items systematically, quietly, for over a year. Small pieces first, then larger ones. By the time your father noticed, a significant portion of what your mother had left you was gone." Rose closed her eyes for a moment. She had known some of this. She had noticed the empty spaces in her mother's jewelry box, the missing portrait miniature that had always sat on the mantelpiece, the set of silver hairpins that had been a wedding gift. She had told herself that things got moved, got lost, got misplaced during grief. She had wanted very much to believe that. "He couldn't prove it," she said. "It was not a question." "No, Vivienne was careful. And your father was ill and did not have the energy to fight a legal battle he was not certain he could win, against a woman living under his own roof." The Duke's voice was measured, but underneath it Rose could hear something restrained, a controlled anger, held at a careful distance. "What he could do was write to me. He knew I had legal resources he did not. He knew I could do, after he was gone, what he could not do while he was alive." "And the jewelry, the ruby brooch. A fiction, created to explain why you might be untrustworthy, to preempt anything you might say about Vivienne after your father died. If the village already believed you had stolen from your own family, who would listen to you?" Rose sat with that for a moment. It was strange, hearing the architecture of it described so plainly. She had lived inside Vivienne's construction for 4 years, had felt its walls, had knocked against its edges, but she had never been able to see its shape from the outside. Now she could. It was almost elegant in a terrible way. Build the story before the girl can speak. Make her the villain before she knows she's in a story at all. "She told me once," Rose said quietly, "that I should be grateful she hadn't gone to the magistrate, that she had protected me out of love for my father." She paused. "I believed her for almost a year." The Duke was very still across the table. "I am sorry," he said. Simply, directly, without the careful social cushioning that people usually wrapped around apologies. Just the words themselves, plain and genuine. Rose looked up at him. She was not accustomed to being apologized to. It took her a moment to know what to do with it. "It wasn't your fault," she said. "I should have found you sooner." "You said you tried." "I did, but trying and succeeding are different things." He picked up his wine glass, set it down again without drinking. "I hired someone to locate you. He found the house in the country but reported that you had been," he paused, "described by Lady Vivienne as having gone to stay with distant relatives, voluntarily, that you preferred the quiet and did not wish to receive visitors." Rose let out a short breath that was almost a laugh. "She told me, around that same time, that I ought to be grateful for the roof over my head and stop imagining that anyone in London was thinking about me." "She was making sure of it," the Duke said, "on both ends." They sat in silence for a moment. Around them, the supper room murmured and clinked and carried on, entirely unaware that at this small table near the window, 4 years of careful lies were being taken apart piece by piece. "There is something I need to ask you," the Duke said. His voice shifted slightly, still calm, but with a different quality now, more careful. "And I want you to take your time answering." Rose looked at him. "Your father's letter contained more than an account of what Vivienne had done. It also contained documents, records of your mother's jewelry, descriptions, valuations, dates of acquisition, a copy of your mother's will which named you as the sole beneficiary of her personal estate, and a written account in your father's own hand of what he had witnessed Vivienne do and when." He paused. "These documents are legally significant. With them, a case could be made to recover what was taken from you. To restore your mother's estate, or its equivalent value, to you. And to formally correct the public record regarding the accusation against your character." Rose stared at him. "You have all of this," she said slowly. "You have had it."
"Yes."
"For how long?" A brief pause. 7 months. 7 months. Rose counted backwards in her head. 7 months ago, she had been in the country house, mending curtains in a room that used to be a guest room, that Vivienne had decided Rose should occupy because it was smaller and faced north and got no afternoon light. 7 months ago, she had been eating supper alone in the kitchen because Vivienne had started having her meals served separately, in the interest, she said, of Rose's own comfort. 7 months ago, the Duke of Ravenswood had been holding documents that could have ended all of it. She became aware that her hands were very still in her lap, and that she was looking at the table again, and that her jaw was tight. "Why tonight?" she said. She heard the edge in her own voice and did not try to smooth it. "If you have had this for 7 months, if my father trusted you with this, why did you wait until now? Why a ball? Why?" she stopped. "Why not simply write to you?" he finished quietly.
"Yes."
He was quiet for a moment. Not uncomfortable, more as though he was giving the question the respect it deserved. "Because I had learned what happened the last time someone tried to reach you by letter," he said. "I could not be certain the letter would reach you. I could not be certain Vivienne wouldn't intercept it." He paused. "And because I had discovered in the process of all of this that Lady Vivienne has a deep investment in appearing respectable, in appearing to be exactly what she presented to your father, a woman of good character, properly placed in society. He looked at Rose steadily. She would never cause a scene in public. She would never let her composure break in front of witnesses. If you were here in this room with me, she could not maneuver the way she can when you are isolated and alone. Rose considered this. It was, she had to admit, logical. It was also cold in its logic, the kind of cold that came from thinking very clearly and very carefully about something, from every angle before acting. She looked at the man across the table. She thought about the fact that her father, in the last months of his life, had trusted this man enough to put everything in a letter and send it to him. Her father had been, above most things, a good judge of character. It was the one failure of that quality, Vivienne, that had cost them everything. "What happens now?" she asked. "That depends somewhat on you," the Duke said. "I can move forward through legal channels, which will be slow and will require you to be present in London for some months, and will be public in ways that may be uncomfortable." He paused. "Or we can resolve part of it tonight." Rose looked at him sharply. "The documents are here," he said. "I brought them. If you are willing, I would like to present them this evening in this room in front of witnesses. Lady Vivienne is here. The people she has told your story to are here. The magistrate I have retained is, as it happens, also here. I invited him specifically." Rose felt the breath leave her body. "You planned all of this," she said.
"Yes."
"The invitation, the dance, the supper, all of it."
"Yes."
She stared at him. Something that might have been anger moved through her, the instinct to resist being managed, being placed, being moved around a board like a piece in someone else's game, even a game being played on her behalf. But underneath the anger was something else, something that was looking at the careful, deliberate architecture of this evening, the invitation sent to her specifically, the majordomo who had been expecting her, the dance in front of the whole room and recognizing in all of it, the same thing she had seen in her father's face in those last months at the window. Someone who had seen what was coming, and had tried with everything available to them to stop it. She thought about what it had cost her father to write that letter. A proud man, a private man, admitting in writing that he had failed to protect his daughter. Sending that failure to an old friend and asking him to do what he himself could not. She thought about the man across the table, who had spent 7 months trying to find her, who had built an entire evening around the one circumstance under which she could not be disappeared or maneuvered away. She thought about the north-facing room, with no afternoon light. "All right," she said. The Duke looked at her. "All right," she said again more steadily, "let's finish it." Something moved across his face then, not triumph, not satisfaction in the way she might have expected from a man who had arranged everything so precisely. It was something quieter than that, something that looked almost like relief. He stood, he offered her his hand. Rose took it and stood beside him in her pale blue dress in the supper room of Ravenswood House and felt something settle in her chest. Not peace, not yet. But the beginning of it, the very first edge of it, like light coming under a door. "Miss Ashworth," the Duke said quietly before they moved, "whatever happens in the next hour, whatever is said, whatever Vivienne does, I want you to know that you will not be standing alone." Rose looked at him for a long moment. "I haven't stood beside anyone in a very long time," she said. "I know," he said. "I intend to change that." And they walked back into the ballroom together. The ballroom had changed in the hour they had been gone. Rose felt at the moment they stepped back through the doors, a shift in the atmosphere, subtle but unmistakable the way the air changes before a storm. The music was still playing, the candles were still burning, the women were still moving in their silk and their pearls. But there was an alertness to the room now, a collective leaning in that had not been there before. Word had traveled, as word always did in rooms like this, quickly and with embellishment. The Duke had danced with the Ashworth girl. The Duke had taken her into supper. The Duke had sat with her for an hour, alone, at a table by the window, and had not looked once at anyone else. Rose could feel the speculation landing on her like light through glass, warm in patches, sharp in others. She kept her hand on the Duke's arm and her chin level, and walked as though she had been doing this all her life. She spotted Vivienne before Vivienne spotted her. Her stepmother was standing near the fireplace with a small group of women, three of them, all of a certain age, all of a certain type, the kind of women who had known each other for 30 years and whose good opinion was, in certain circles, worth more than a banker's letter of credit. Lady Harcastle, Rose thought she recognized, and beside her someone whose name she didn't know but whose posture radiated consequence. Vivienne was speaking to them with great animation, her hands moving in small, elegant gestures, her expression carefully arranged into something that managed to convey both reluctance and concern, the expression of a woman sharing something painful that she would much rather not have to share. Rose watched her stepmother's mouth move and felt a cold, clear anger settle somewhere in the center of her chest, not the hot, helpless anger she had felt in the country house, the kind that had nowhere to go and so turned inward. This was different. This was the anger of someone who can see, for the first time, the full shape of the thing that has been done to them. "She's telling them now," Rose said quietly. "Yes," the Duke said, equally quiet. "Building it higher before I can knock it down. That is what I would expect her to do." Rose watched for another moment. Vivienne was leaning in slightly, her voice dropping, her audience leaning in with her. One of the women glanced toward Rose and then quickly away, which told Rose everything she needed to know about the content of the conversation. "Where is the magistrate?" Rose asked. "Near the east wall, the gray-haired gentleman in the blue coat speaking to Lord Fenwick." Rose found him without appearing to look. Sir Edmund Graves, she remembered the name from something her father had said once, years ago, in a different life. A fair man, her father had said, careful and fair. "And the documents?" "In my study. I will send for them when the moment is right." "When is the moment right?" The Duke glanced at her sideways. When Vivienne has said enough in front of enough witnesses that her own words become the evidence against her. Rose understood. She did not entirely like it, standing here while her stepmother poisoned more ears felt like swallowing glass, deliberate and slow, but she understood. Let Vivienne build the case against herself. Let the room be full of people who had heard it from her own mouth, tonight, in front of each other, before the truth arrived to dismantle it. She breathed in slowly, she breathed out. "All right," she said, "we wait." They did not have to wait long. Vivienne saw them approximately 4 minutes later. The moment her eyes found Rose standing at the Duke's side, composed, not fled, not humiliated, not quietly removed from the premises as she had clearly expected, something happened to her face. It was brief, half a second at most, quickly controlled. But Rose saw it. She suspected the Duke saw it too. It was the expression of someone whose plan has failed and who is, very rapidly, building a new one. Vivienne excused herself from her companions with a gracious smile and moved across the room. Not rushing, Vivienne never rushed, would never give anyone the satisfaction of seeing her rush, but with a purpose that cut through the crowd like a current. She stopped in front of them. Her smile was extraordinary. Rose had always known her stepmother was beautiful, in the way that very controlled, very deliberate people can be beautiful, everything in its precise place, nothing accidental, nothing unguarded. Tonight she was magnificent and terrifying and completely composed. "Your Grace," she said warmly, directing herself entirely at the Duke as though Rose were a piece of furniture standing slightly too close. "I hope you have been well entertained this evening. You are too kind to spend so much time with Rose. She is not always easy company, I am afraid. She has always been rather intense. I have found Miss Ashworth's company entirely agreeable, the Duke said pleasantly. A beat, of course. Vivienne's smile did not shift. She can be charming when she chooses to be. It is one of the things that makes certain situations so complicated. She sighed lightly, the sigh of a woman burdened by difficult truths. I have always protected her, you understand, even when it was not easy, even when certain things came to light that made it very challenging. What things would those be? The Duke asked. His voice was perfectly neutral, a man asking a simple question at a social gathering. Vivienne tilted her head slightly, as though considering whether to continue a performance, Rose noted, of reluctance, of a woman who would so much rather not speak, but finds herself with no choice. I am sure Rose has told you her own version of events, Vivienne said delicately. She is a gifted storyteller, but the truth is, and I say this with great sadness, because she is my husband's daughter and I have tried so very hard, Rose has always had a complicated relationship with what belongs to her and what does not. The incident with her mother's jewelry was not, I am sorry to say, entirely isolated. Rose felt the Duke's arm tighten very slightly under her hand. She pressed her own hand down slightly, a small signal, not yet. I see, the Duke said. And what other incidents would you be referring to? Vivienne glanced at Rose directly, briefly, with a look that managed to communicate both pity and warning in a single second. Then she looked back at the Duke. There was money missing from the household accounts, she said, more than once, small amounts, which is why I never pressed the matter formally. I could not bear to, she is my husband's daughter. She paused for effect. And there was a letter that arrived for me some months ago from a legal representative. I believe it concerned my late husband's estate. It never reached me. I can only assume it was intercepted. The air around Rose went very cold. A letter from a legal representative. She thought of the Duke saying, I tried to find you. She thought of him saying, Lady Vivienne is very good at making things difficult to find. You are accusing Miss Ashworth, the Duke said, still pleasantly, of stealing money from your household accounts and intercepting your legal correspondence. I am not accusing, Vivienne said softly. I am simply sharing what I know with someone I trust to be discreet. I would never take any formal action. She is family. How generous of you, the Duke said. Vivienne smiled. It was at this moment that Cecily appeared. She came from the edge of the crowd, her face pale and uncertain, her evening gown a pale pink that should have made her look lovely, but tonight only made her look young. She was 23 years younger than Rose, and she had her mother's dark hair and her mother's fine features, and none of her mother's certainty about anything. Mama, she said quietly, arriving at Vivienne's elbow, perhaps we should. Not now, Cecily. Mama, Cecily's voice was small, but she did not stop. I think you should stop. Vivienne turned to look at her daughter with an expression that Rose recognized from the inside of the north-facing room. The expression that ended conversations, that closed doors, that reminded you precisely how little ground you were standing on. But Cecily, to Rose's considerable surprise, did not look away. I heard you, Cecily said. Her voice was shaking slightly, but she kept it going. Earlier tonight, when you were speaking to Lady Harcastle and the others, I heard what you said about Rose and the money. Mama, that isn't that didn't, she stopped, swallowed. That didn't happen. The silence around them expanded outward. The nearest couples had stopped pretending not to listen. Vivienne's expression shifted into something smooth and maternal and deeply warning. Cecily, darling, you are tired. Why don't you? I'm not tired, Cecily said. She was looking at Rose now, not at her mother, and her expression was complicated in a way that Rose had not expected, not guilt exactly, not quite shame, but the expression of someone who has been carrying something heavy for a long time and has just decided to put it down. "I'm sorry," she said, to Rose, directly, quietly, in front of the Duke and the encroaching ring of interested listeners. "I should have said something before. I didn't know all of it. I didn't know about Grandfather's letter or the jewelry. I didn't know the details. But I knew about the money. I knew that wasn't true." The room was very quiet now. Vivienne's composure held. Rose would give her that. It held magnificently, the way a wall holds right up until the moment it doesn't. Her expression shifted into something sorrowful, something that said "my poor confused child" without using the words. "Cecily has always been sensitive," she said to the Duke with a small, pained smile. "She and Rose were close once, and she has never entirely." "Lady Vivienne." The Duke's voice had changed. Still even, still measured, but the pleasantness was gone, cleanly and completely, the way a cloth is pulled from a table. Vivienne stopped. "I think," the Duke said, "that this conversation has reached the point where I should introduce you to someone." He looked across the room and made a small gesture, barely a movement of two fingers, and the gray-haired man in the blue coat detached himself from his conversation with Lord Fenwick and began to make his way over. Vivienne watched him come. Rose watched Vivienne watch him. She saw the moment her stepmother recognized him, saw it in the fractional tightening around her eyes, the almost imperceptible stilling of her hands. "Lady Vivienne," the Duke said, "may I introduce Sir Edmund Graves? Sir Edmund is a magistrate of some 20 years' experience, and he has, over the past 7 months, been assisting me in reviewing certain legal matters pertaining to the estate of the late Mr. Ashworth." Sir Edmund Graves bowed slightly. "Lady Vivienne," he said. His voice was dry and precise, the voice of a man who had heard a great many stories in his career and had developed a reliable sense of which ones were true. "Vivienne began. I wonder," Sir Edmund said mildly, "if you might be willing to clarify a few points regarding your late husband's will. Specifically, certain items listed in the personal estate of the late Mrs. Ashworth." He glanced at Rose briefly, a small professional acknowledgement. "Miss Ashworth's mother, that do not appear to have been transferred according to the terms of the will." Vivienne was silent. It was the first time, Rose realized, that she had ever seen her stepmother at a loss for words. The experience was extraordinary. The silence where Vivienne's voice usually was felt enormous, like a room that has had all its furniture removed at once. "I don't know what you're referring to," Vivienne said at last. Her voice was still composed, but something underneath it had gone tight. "I suspect you do," Sir Edmund said, with the same mild precision. "But there is no need to discuss it here this evening. I will call at your residence tomorrow morning at 10, if that is convenient." He paused. "I recommend bringing your solicitor." The color that had left Vivienne's face came back, briefly, in two high spots across her cheekbones. Then she did the thing Rose would not have predicted. She turned on Rose. "Not on the Duke, not on Sir Edmund, not on the magistrate or the documents or the 7 months of careful preparation that had built this moment." She turned on Rose, stepped toward her, so that they were close enough that Rose could see the fine lines around her eyes that her powder usually concealed. And she spoke quietly, furiously, in a voice designed to carry no further than the two of them. "You have no idea," Vivienne said, "what your father was, what he left me with, what I built from nothing after he wasted everything on sentiment and poor decisions." Her eyes were bright and hard, the kind of hard that comes not from coldness but from pressure sustained for a very long time. "I kept that household running. I kept food on the table and coal in the grate, and I did what needed doing while you sat in your room and grieved prettily and waited for someone to take care of you." Rose held her ground. She did not step back. "You stole from me," Rose said. Her voice was very quiet and very clear. "That is what you did, whatever else is true, that is true. Something moved through Vivienne's face. Something that was almost briefly, an expression Rose couldn't name. Something that existed behind all the performance and the calculation, behind the silk and the diamonds and the extraordinary social machinery. Something that might, in a different life, have been a person. Then it was gone. Vivienne straightened. She looked once at Cecily, who was standing very still with her hands clasped in front of her. She looked once at the Duke. She looked, last of all, at the ring of people who had stopped even pretending not to watch. Then she turned and walked out of the ballroom. Not rushed, not running, walking at exactly the right pace with her head exactly at the right angle, as though she were leaving of her own choice, for her own reasons, on her own terms. Right up until the end, Rose thought. Right up until the very end, she controls the exit. The room exhaled. Cecily made a small, involuntary sound, not quite a sob, not quite a breath, and pressed her hand over her mouth. She was looking at the door where her mother had gone. Her face was the face of someone in the middle of a very complicated grief. Rose looked at her. She thought about 4 years. She thought about what Cecily had just done, had stood in the middle of that room, in front of witnesses, and told the truth about her own mother at cost to herself, at risk to herself, without being asked. Rose crossed to her stepsister. Cecily looked up, startled, her eyes bright with unshed tears. "You didn't know," Rose said. "Not a question exactly, more an acknowledgement." "Not all of it," Cecily's voice was unsteady. "I knew I suspected some things, but I told myself," she stopped, swallowed. "I told myself it wasn't as bad as it seemed." "That is what we do," Rose said. "When we live inside something, we tell ourselves it isn't as bad as it seems." Cecily looked at her for a long moment. Then her face crumpled just slightly at the edges. "I'm sorry, Rose," she said. "I am so sorry." Rose stood with that for a moment. She thought about all the things she could say, the 4 years, the north-facing room, the cold suppers in the kitchen, the story about the ruby brooch that had followed her like a shadow into every room she tried to enter. She thought about what it had cost Cecily to speak tonight. A young woman with nothing to fall back on, no father, no independent income, whose entire social position rested on her mother's standing, who had looked at all of that and had spoken anyway. "I know," Rose said finally. And then, because she was who she was and because her father had raised her to be, she added, "It will be all right. I will make sure of it." Cecily blinked. "Why would you, after everything?" "Because you are not your mother," Rose said simply, "and because my father would have wanted me to." She left Cecily standing by the fireplace and walked back to where the Duke was waiting. Sir Edmund had drifted discreetly away, back toward Lord Fenwick and the relative neutrality of the East Wall. Around the ballroom, conversation was slowly resuming, people turning back to their partners with their eyes bright and their voices low, the particular animated energy of a room that has just witnessed something it will be talking about for months. The Duke looked at her as she returned to his side. He said nothing for a moment. "You offered to help Cecily," he said finally. Not a question, he had clearly been close enough to hear.
"Yes."
"After everything her mother did."
"She isn't her mother."
He was quiet for a moment, looking at her with that expression she was starting to recognize. The one she couldn't quite name, that wasn't quite a smile but was something in the same direction. "Your father," he said, "described you to me in his letter. He said you were," his exact word was asterisk formidable. "He said it was the quality he was most proud of and most worried about." Rose felt something move in her throat. "Proud because you would not be broken," the Duke continued. "Worried because the world is not always kind to formidable women." Rose looked at the ballroom, the candles, the silk, the marble floor, the portraits on the walls of men who had all died important.
He was right about both, she said.
He was. The Duke turned to face her more fully. Miss Ashworth, the documents are still in my study. Sir Edmund will call on Lady Vivienne tomorrow morning. The legal process will take some months and will require patience and will at certain points be tedious and uncomfortable. He paused. But at the end of it, your mother's estate will be returned to you. The public record will be corrected. The story Lady Vivienne has been telling about you will be replaced with the true one. Rose nodded slowly, and in the meantime, the Duke said, you will need somewhere to stay in London. A respectable address with appropriate staff where you are not dependent on Lady Vivienne's hospitality. He paused. I have a property in Mayfair, a townhouse, currently empty, that I would make available to you with complete propriety through my solicitor as a formal arrangement, if you would accept it. Rose looked at him. That is very generous. It is practical, he said, in a tone that suggested he was very deliberately not calling it generous. It is both, Rose said. The suggestion of a smile again, perhaps. The music had started up once more, something slower now, a gentle progression of strings that moved through the room like a tide coming in. Around them, the ballroom settled back into its rhythms, couples finding each other, conversations rebuilding themselves, the extraordinary machinery of a society evening rolling forward as it always did, regardless of what had just happened at its edges. Rose stood beside the Duke of Ravenswood in her pale blue dress and thought about tomorrow, about Sir Edmund Graves arriving at Vivienne's door at 10 in the morning, about a townhouse in Mayfair, about legal processes and patience and the slow work of replacing one story with another. It was not over, she knew that. These things were never over in a single evening, whatever the ballroom stories suggested. There would be difficulty ahead, and tedium, and moments where it would feel very far from finished. But something was different now. Something fundamental had shifted tonight in this room in a way that could not be unshifted. She was no longer alone in it. Your Grace, she said.
Yes.
She looked up at him. Thank you for the letter to my father for trying to find me for all of this, she paused. He chose well, I think, when he wrote to you. The Duke looked at her for a long moment. Something in his face was very still and very open, in a way she suspected it rarely was. So did I, he said quietly, when I sent the invitation. The music continued. The candles burned. Outside, London moved through its dark and scattered rhythms, entirely indifferent. And inside Ravenswood House, for the first time in 4 years, Rose Ashworth allowed herself to breathe. The weeks that followed were unlike anything Rose had experienced in 4 years. Not because they were easy. They were not easy. Legal processes, she discovered, moved at the pace of very old men climbing very steep staircases, deliberately, carefully, with frequent pauses to consult documents and adjust spectacles and murmur things to other very old men who then murmured things back. Sir Edmund Graves was efficient and thorough and entirely without urgency, which Rose was told was a professional virtue, but which she found, on certain gray London mornings, to be profoundly maddening. But she was in London. She was in the Mayfair townhouse, which was smaller than Ravenswood House, but larger than anything she had occupied in 4 years, with south-facing windows that let in the afternoon light and a small garden at the back that was overgrown but salvageable, and a housekeeper named Mrs. Pratt who was 63 years old and had the disposition of someone who had seen everything twice and found it all mildly amusing. You'll want tea, Mrs. Pratt said on the first morning, before Rose had said anything at all.
Yes, Rose said, please.
And something to eat. You're too thin.
I'm perfectly...
Too thin, Mrs. Pratt said, with the finality of a woman who has closed the subject and went to make tea. Rose had stood in the hallway of the townhouse, with its faded wallpaper and its good bones and its afternoon light already beginning to find the windows, and it felt something she did not immediately know how to name. It took her several minutes, standing there with her small bag and her pale blue dress, and the sound of Mrs. Pratt moving in the kitchen below, before she identified it. She felt safe. It was so unfamiliar that she had not recognized it at first. The Duke called twice in the first week, formally, correctly, at appropriate hours, with his card sent ahead and Mrs. Pratt posted in the sitting room with her knitting, maintaining the proprieties with the efficiency of someone who had been doing this for 40 years and found it all perfectly straightforward. The first visit was brief, primarily practical, an update from Sir Edmund on the initial stages of the legal review, documents to sign, questions to answer about dates and descriptions, and the sequence of events as Rose remembered them. The Duke sat across from her at the small writing table by the window and they worked through it methodically, and Rose was grateful for the work because it gave her something to do with her hands and her attention and the complicated interior weather of the preceding week. The second visit was less brief. Sir Edmund's business was concluded in the first half hour. After that, the Duke stayed. Mrs. Pratt's knitting needles continued at their steady rhythm in the corner, and outside the window the London afternoon moved through its gray November light, and the Duke asked Rose about her father. Not about the estate, not about the legal particulars. About her father himself, what he had been like, what they had talked about, what she remembered of him before the illness. Rose had not talked about her father to anyone in 4 years. She had thought about him constantly, in the way you think about something you cannot afford to feel, carefully, briefly, from a distance, putting it away again quickly before it could open into something larger. She had not had anyone to talk to him with. She talked for almost an hour. The Duke listened in the way that very few people listen, not waiting for his turn, not assembling his response while she was still speaking, but actually present, actually attending, in a way she felt in the quality of his stillness across the table. He asked questions occasionally, small precise ones that opened things rather than redirecting them. He laughed once when she described her father's catastrophic attempt to teach her chess, which had ended with the board overturned, and her father declaring that the game was fundamentally flawed and he had always preferred cards anyway. It was the first time she had laughed about her father, the first time remembering him had felt like something other than loss. When the Duke left, she sat in the sitting room for a long time after, while Mrs. Pratt collected the tea things and the afternoon light faded, and she held the feeling carefully, examining it from different angles, not entirely sure what to do with it. The legal process ground forward. Sir Edmund called on Lady Vivienne as promised, and reported to the Duke that she had been his word, asterisk, resistant. She had denied everything, had produced her own solicitor within 24 hours, and had settled in for what appeared to be a prolonged campaign of technical obstruction. She was, Sir Edmund noted with professional admiration he did not entirely conceal, extremely competent at this. She knew exactly which documents to question, which dates to dispute, which procedural challenges would cost the most time. "She has done this before," Sir Edmund told the Duke, in the sitting room of the Mayfair townhouse, with Rose present because the Duke had insisted she be present for all updates regarding her own affairs. Not necessarily this specifically, but she understands legal process and how to slow it. Someone taught her, or she taught herself. "How long?" Rose asked. "If she contests everything, 6 months, perhaps 8. Rose absorbed this. 8 months of Vivienne obstructing and delaying, and telling her version of events to anyone who would listen, while Rose waited in a borrowed townhouse for a process she could not control to reach its conclusion. "Is there anything that would accelerate it?" the Duke asked. Sir Edmund considered. Witnesses,
people willing to give formal statements regarding what they observed at the ball, Lady Vivienne's statements to other guests about Miss Ashworth. The more witnesses, the harder it becomes to sustain the denial. He paused, and Cecily. The name settled into the room. Cecily won't testify against her mother, Rose said immediately. Not because she was certain of it, she was not, after what Cecily had done at the ball, but because it felt wrong to assume she would. She had already given more than could have been expected of her. To ask for more felt like using her. No one would be asked to testify against anyone, Sir Edmund said carefully. A statement of what she witnessed over the course of her time in the household, what she observed, not interpretation, simply observation. He paused again. She is an adult. The choice would be entirely hers. Rose looked at the window. Outside, a thin November rain was beginning, graying the garden further, running in small rivers down the glass. I will speak to her, she said, but I will not ask her to do it. I will simply tell her it is an option, and that whatever she decides I will, she stopped, found the word, support. The Duke was looking at her with that expression again, the one she had stopped trying to name. Agreed, he said. She wrote to Cecily the following morning. It was a difficult letter to write, four drafts before she found the right register. Not too warm, not too formal. Acknowledging what had passed between them at the ball without making it into more than it was, being honest about the legal situation without making Cecily feel pressured or implicated. She wrote it at the small desk in the corner of the sitting room while Mrs. Pratt polished silver in the background, and the rain continued outside, and she thought about the girl she had last seen standing at the edge of the ballroom with her hands clasped, and her face very pale and her eyes bright with something that looked like a person deciding who they were. Cecily replied within 2 days. The letter was short and slightly uneven in its handwriting, as though written quickly or with feeling. I have been waiting for you to write. I am sorry it took you this long and also sorry that it fell to you to write first when it should have been me. Yes, I will give a statement. Not because I am angry at Mama, I am, but that is not the reason. Because it is the right thing, and because my father would have wanted me to, and because you told me it would be all right, and I find that I believe you. P.S., where are you staying? Mama says she doesn't know, but I suspect she does, and is simply not telling me. Rose read it twice. Then she put it down and sat quietly for a moment. Then she picked up her pen and wrote back the address. Cecily came the following Thursday, arriving at the Mayfair townhouse in a hired carriage with a single small bag, wearing a coat that was slightly too light for the weather and an expression of someone who has made a significant decision and is trying very hard not to look as frightened as they feel. Mrs. Pratt took her coat without comment and produced tea with the efficiency of someone who had been told to expect company and had prepared accordingly. The two young women sat across from each other in the sitting room, in the south-facing light, with their tea and their complicated history, and Rose thought, we were strangers when we lived in the same house. Perhaps we will be something else now that we don't. Where are you staying? Rose asked. I was at home, Cecily said, with Mama, but she has been, she paused, choosing the word carefully, very difficult to live with since the ball. She believes I betrayed her. Did you tell her you were coming here? No, a small, slightly guilty pause. I left a note.
Lana.
She will be furious.
Yes.
Cecily wrapped both hands around her teacup. She was quiet for a moment, looking into the tea as though it might have something useful to say. Can I stay? She said finally. Just for a few days, until things are clearer. Rose thought about the north-facing room. She thought about the cold suppers in the kitchen. She thought about 4 years of being managed and diminished and disbelieved, and the complicated question of what you do with that, whether you carry it forward into every room you subsequently enter, or whether you find somewhere the specific and difficult capacity to put it down. She thought about her father, about what he would have said. "Yes," she said, "of course you can stay." Cecily looked up. Her eyes were very bright. "Thank you," she said softly. "The bedroom is on the second floor," Rose said. "Mrs. Pratt will show you." And Cecily, she waited until her stepsister met her eyes. "Whatever happens with the legal proceedings, whatever happens with your mother, you are not responsible for what she did. I need you to know that I understand that." Cecily's composure, which had been very carefully maintained since she had walked through the door, cracked then, just slightly, at the edges. She pressed her lips together, nodded once. "Your father was a good man," she said, her voice slightly unsteady. "Mine was too. I think they would have been friends if things had been different." "I think so too," Rose said. Mrs. Pratt appeared in the doorway with the timing of a woman who has been listening from the hallway and judges that the moment has arrived. "Second floor," she said to Cecily. "I'll bring fresh towels." The Duke called 3 days later to find the sitting room occupied by both young women, Cecily working on a piece of embroidery with intense concentration, and Rose reading correspondence from Sir Edmund that she had spread across the writing table in what Mrs. Pratt referred to, with professional disapproval, as asterisk quite a state. He took in the scene with a single comprehensive glance. "Miss Cecily," he said with perfect composure, "I am glad to see you well." Cecily looked up from her embroidery with the expression of someone confronted unexpectedly by a duke. "Your Grace, yes, thank you, I am, yes." "She's staying for a few days," Rose said, without looking up from Sir Edmund's letter. "I see." The Duke sat in the chair across from the writing table. Mrs. Pratt appeared with tea before he had fully settled, with the supernatural efficiency she deployed when the Duke visited. "And how does that suit you both?" "Very well," Rose said. She set down the letter. "Cecily has agreed to provide a statement to Sir Edmund. We are discussing the particulars." The Duke looked at Cecily. Cecily looked back at him with the determined expression of someone who has decided something and is not going to be undecided by a duke, however large his house is. "I know what my mother did," Cecily said. "I should have said so sooner. I am saying so now." "That is courageous," the Duke said simply. Cecily blinked as though she had been braced for something more complicated. "Oh," she said, "thank you. Sir Edmund will want to speak with you in the next week, if you're willing. I will arrange it." "Yes, all right." The Duke turned back to Rose, who had picked up the letter again. "There is news," he said. Something in his tone made her put the letter down. "Lady Harcastle," he said, "and two other women who were present at the ball when Vivienne spoke to them. They have all agreed to provide written accounts of what Lady Vivienne said to them that evening, regarding you." He paused. "Lady Harcastle was, I will use her word, incensed. She said she does not appreciate being used as an instrument of a deception, and that she has known families destroyed by exactly this kind of carefully managed gossip, and that she intends to say so formally and at length." Rose stared at him. "Lady Harcastle," she repeated, "who was standing with Vivienne when I arrived?" "The same." "She was listening. She was one of the ones Vivienne was telling." "Yes." Rose sat with this for a moment. She thought about the way the room had shifted at the ball, the way Vivienne had moved through it with such confidence, directing the narrative, building the architecture of the evening around her own purposes. She had chosen her audience so carefully. She had chosen women of consequence, women whose good opinion mattered, women whose whispers traveled. She had not, apparently, considered that those same women might not appreciate the discovery that they had been chosen precisely because their whispers traveled. "She miscalculated," Rose said slowly. "In several respects," the Duke agreed. Cecily had put down her embroidery. She was listening with an expression that was somewhere between grief and relief, The expression of someone watching something they had known was wrong for a long time finally being named as such out loud. What does this mean? Rose asked, in practical terms for the timeline. It means, the Duke said, that Sir Edmund now has enough to proceed significantly faster than he initially estimated. Lady Vivienne's solicitor will find his obstruction strategy considerably less effective against this volume of consistent testimony. He paused. Sir Edmund believes we may be looking at weeks rather than months. The afternoon light came through the south-facing windows. The garden below was still overgrown, still gray with November, but there was something in it, some quality of the light or the way the bare branches moved in the wind, that looked, to Rose's eye, like the beginning of something rather than the end.
Weeks, she said. Yes.
She looked at the Duke across the writing table, with Sir Edmund's letter spread between them and Cecily's embroidery in the background, and Mrs. Pratt's footsteps moving steadily below, and the London afternoon doing what London afternoons did, entirely indifferent to the things that were changing inside this small south-facing room. Then we are nearly there, she said. Nearly, the Duke said. He was looking at her with that expression again, the one she had spent 6 weeks trying to name and had finally, quietly, in the privacy of her own thoughts, admitted to herself that she had named, that she had known what it was for some time and had simply been waiting for a moment that felt safe enough to acknowledge it. Rose, he said. It was the first time he had used her name without the miss in front of it. He appeared to notice immediately that he had done it a brief, very slight pause, barely perceptible, and did not correct it. She did not correct it either.
Yes, she said.
He looked at the window for a moment, then back at her. When this is finished, he said carefully, when Sir Edmund has concluded and the record has been corrected, and you have your mother's estate returned to you, what will you do? It was a practical question. She recognized it as a practical question. And yet there was something underneath the practicality, something in the particular quality of stillness he had when he asked it, the way he was watching her, the way the room felt slightly different now than it had 5 minutes ago, that told her it was not entirely a practical question. She held his gaze. I haven't decided, she said. I have been trying not to think too far ahead. It felt premature. And now? She looked at the south-facing windows, at the overgrown garden below, at the afternoon light that came in freely and without obstruction and fell across everything in the room with complete impartiality. Now, she said slowly, I think perhaps I can afford to think a little further ahead. The Duke said nothing, but something in his face, very quietly and without announcement, settled into an expression that Rose had never seen on it before. It looked, she thought, remarkably like happiness. The letter from Sir Edmund arrived on a Tuesday morning in December, 3 weeks after the Duke's visit, delivered by a young man in a gray coat who handed it to Mrs. Pratt with the gravity of someone who understood he was carrying something significant and wanted appropriate credit for it. Mrs. Pratt brought it upstairs on a small silver tray. She had produced the silver tray from somewhere in the third week of Rose's residence and deployed it for all correspondence she considered important, which was a category she appeared to determine by some private internal system Rose had never fully decoded. Rose was at the writing desk, working through a list of her mother's jewelry that Sir Edmund had asked her to compile from memory, descriptions, approximate dates, anything she could recall. It was painstaking work, requiring her to move carefully through a part of her memory she had kept mostly closed, opening drawers she had shut years ago and examining what was inside them. She had been doing it in small portions, an hour at a time, with tea at regular intervals and Mrs. Pratt checking in with the frequency of someone who understood what the work was costing without being told. She recognized Sir Edmund's seal on the envelope before she picked it up. She set down her pen. She did not open it immediately. She sat with it in her hands for a moment, feeling its weight, the particular density of an envelope that contains more than one page. Then she broke the seal and read. She read it once quickly, the way you read something when your heart is going faster than your eyes. Then she set it down on the desk and sat very still for approximately 30 seconds. Then she picked it up and read it again, slowly, making sure she had understood each sentence correctly and was not constructing meaning that wasn't there. She had not constructed meaning that wasn't there. She put the letter down. "Mrs. Pratt," she called. Mrs. Pratt appeared in the doorway with the speed of someone who had been waiting in the hallway, which Rose suspected she had been. "We need to send a message to Ravenswood House," Rose said. Her voice came out entirely steady, which surprised her slightly. "As soon as possible, please." Mrs. Pratt looked at her face. Then she looked at the letter on the desk. "I'll send William directly," she said, and was gone before Rose had finished nodding. The Duke arrived within the hour. He came into the sitting room without his usual composure fully assembled, which was so unlike him that Rose noticed it immediately, a slight unevenness in his manner, a quality of barely contained urgency underneath the correct social surface. He had come quickly. She found she was glad of it. Cecily had tactfully removed herself to the garden with a shawl and a book, and the determined expression of someone giving people privacy, regardless of the December temperature. Rose handed him the letter without preamble. He read it standing up, which he never did, which told her something about his state of mind. She watched his face as he read, the controlled stillness of it, and then the thing that moved underneath the stillness when he reached the relevant paragraphs. He lowered the letter. "It's done," Rose said. "It's done," he confirmed. She had known it was done from the letter. She had known it for the past hour, sitting at the writing desk with the December light coming in, and Mrs. Pratt's footsteps moving below and Cecily's voice in the garden talking to herself or possibly to the overgrown rose bushes. She had known it and had sat with the knowledge quietly, letting it settle, waiting for it to feel real. It felt real now, with him standing across from her in the sitting room, holding Sir Edmund's letter. It felt entirely real. Lady Vivienne's solicitor had withdrawn his objections. The documentary evidence, her father's letter, the records of her mother's estate, the written accounts of Lady Harcastle and the other women from the ball, Cecily's formal statement, and three additional statements from former members of the Ashworth household staff that Sir Edmund had located with quiet efficiency, had proven in the end too comprehensive to contest. Vivienne had been advised, apparently, by her own solicitor that continuing to fight was not merely unwinnable, but would make things considerably worse. The settlement was complete. The equivalent value of her mother's personal estate, calculated by Sir Edmund's assessors, was to be transferred to Rose within 30 days. A formal written correction regarding the accusations against Rose's character had been submitted to the relevant social and legal bodies, with Lady Vivienne's own signature on it, a condition Sir Edmund had apparently insisted upon with considerable firmness. And the ruby brooch, which had never existed, was formally, legally, permanently declared to have never existed. 4 years, built and dismantled in the end in a matter of weeks by a gray-haired magistrate with a precise voice and a great deal of comprehensive documentation. Rose stood at the window. She was looking at the garden where Cecily had given up the pretense of reading and was instead sitting on the stone bench with her book closed in her lap, her face tilted up toward the December sky with an expression Rose couldn't read from this distance, but which seemed, somehow, peaceful. "She held up, didn't she?" Rose said. "Not quite a question." "Cecily," the Duke came to stand beside her at the window. "Yes, Sir Edmund said her statement was his word was unimpeachable, clear, precise, consistent. She did not embellish and she did not hedge. He paused. She is stronger than she knows. She is, Rose said. She will be all right. I intend to make sure of it. I know you do. The December light was thin and pale, the kind of light that illuminates without warming, that shows everything clearly without flattering anything. The garden below was bare and tangled and full of the evidence of years of neglect. Rose had been thinking about it in odd moments, what it would look like in spring, what could be salvaged, what would need to be started from scratch. She had been thinking about spring. She had not thought about spring in a long time. What will you do now? The Duke asked. It was the same question he had asked 3 weeks ago, in the same room, in a different quality of light. She had said she hadn't decided. She had said she had been afraid to think too far ahead. She turned from the window to look at him. He was watching her with that expression, the one she had named, the one she had stopped pretending she hadn't named. Up close, in the pale December light, it was very clear. It had been clear for some time, she thought. She had simply needed the ground beneath her to be solid enough before she could look at it directly. I have been thinking about that, she said. Have you? Yes, she looked at the garden once more briefly. I would like to stay in London for a while. I find I have developed certain attachments to it, she paused, to certain parts of it. The Duke was very still. The garden needs work, she continued in the same measured tone, and I believe Mrs. Pratt has become attached to me in her way, and it would be unkind to uproot her, and Cecily will need somewhere to stay while she determines her own situation, which may take some time. Another pause. There are a great many practical reasons to remain. There are, the Duke said carefully. And then there is the less practical reason, Rose said. She looked at him directly. She had learned in the past weeks that he responded to directness, that the careful social indirection that characterized most interactions in rooms like this one made him patient and precise and entirely opaque. But that directness opened something in him, some layer of that extraordinary stillness, and let what was underneath it become visible. She saw it now, very clearly. Miss Ashworth, he said, his voice was low and very steady. Rose. Yes, she said simply. To all of it, to the name, to the question underneath the name, to the particular quality of the December afternoon, and the way it felt to be standing in this room, on solid ground, looking at someone who had spent 7 months trying to find her, and had built an entire evening around making sure she could not be disappeared again. Something shifted in his face, that quality she had seen at the ball, when she had taken his hand on the dance floor, that looked like relief, but was larger than relief, deeper than relief, the expression of a man who has been carrying something carefully for a very long time and has just been given permission, finally, to set it down. He reached out and took her hand. Not as he had on the dance floor, not the formal, gloved, social gesture of a man leading a woman through a waltz in front of 200 witnesses. This was different, simpler. His hand around hers, in the pale December light, in the quiet sitting room, with no one watching but the portraits on the wall and Mrs. Pratt's distant industry below. I should tell you, he said, that I did not send that invitation only to right a wrong. I know, Rose said. You know. I suspected it at the ball. I was fairly certain of it by the end of the second week. She looked at him steadily. You are not a man who does things for one reason. No, he said, I am not. My father's letter told you about me, she said, not accusingly, just following the thought, before you ever met me. Yes, he was quiet for a moment. He wrote about you at some length. He wanted me to understand, he wanted whoever came to help you to understand who you were, not just what had been done to you. A pause. He described the chess game. Rose felt the breath catch in her throat. He wrote about the chess game, she said. He said you overturned the board yourself, actually. He said he had been protecting you from that story for years. Rose laughed. It came out slightly unsteadily, and then more steadily, and then she was simply laughing in the sitting room in December, holding the Duke of Ravenswood's hand and laughing about a chess game that had happened in another life entirely. The Duke was smiling, a full, unguarded smile, the kind she had not seen on him before, not the suggestion of one, not the corner of the mouth movement, but the real thing, which changed his whole face into something younger and considerably less intimidating. He also wrote, the Duke said, when the laughter had settled, that you would not be easy to help, that you would resist being arranged or managed, and that whoever tried to assist you should be prepared for someone who would rather do things herself, even at cost to herself, than accept help that came with conditions. He was not wrong, Rose said. He was not. The Duke was still smiling. He said the only way to help you was to give you all the information and then get out of your way, that you would make the right decision if the ground was clear and you could see what you were standing on. Rose thought about the ball, about the letter in her coat lining, and the hired carriage and the cracked mirror, and walking into Ravenswood House entirely alone and finding the majordomo awaiting for her. She thought about the dance, and the supper room, and Sir Edmund Graves in his blue coat, and all the careful architecture of an evening designed not to manage her, but to give her, exactly as her father had described, clear ground and full information. You listened to him, she said softly. He was a wise man. He was, Rose looked down at their joined hands. He would have liked you, I think. I hope so, a pause. I liked him, from the letter alone. I think I would have liked him very much in person. The December afternoon was moving toward evening, the light beginning to go amber at the edges, long and low through the south-facing windows. Below, in the garden, Cecily had apparently surrendered to the cold and was making her way back toward the house, her breath visible in the chill air, her book tucked under her arm. James, Rose said, his given name, she had not used it before. He looked at her. I want to say something clearly, she said, because I find that I have spent 4 years not saying things clearly when I should have, and I do not intend to continue that habit. She held his gaze. I am grateful for everything you did, for my father and for me. I am grateful, and I want you to know that I understand what it cost, the time, the effort, the months of searching. I know that. Rose, let me finish, she pressed his hand slightly. I am grateful, and that is entirely separate from this. She glanced down at their joined hands and back up at him. I want you to know that I am not confusing the two. What I feel, what I have been feeling for some weeks now, with increasing inconvenient clarity, is not gratitude. She paused. It is something considerably more complicated and considerably more interesting than gratitude. The Duke of Ravenswood looked at her for a long moment. Then he lifted her hand and held it for a moment, looking at it, as though he were still getting used to the fact that it was there and was not going to disappear. Rose Ashworth, he said, your father also wrote that you were the most honest person he had ever known. Is that so? He said it was occasionally exhausting. He was right about that, too. I find, the Duke said, that I do not find it exhausting in the least. The door opened, and Cecily came in from the garden in a rush of cold air, her cheeks pink and her book slightly damp, and her expression shifting, when she saw them standing together at the window, into something carefully neutral that did not entirely conceal the small, private smile underneath it. It is absolutely freezing out there, she announced, pulling off her gloves. Someone should do something about that garden. It is completely wild. She went to the fireplace and held her hands out to it without looking at them again, which Rose recognized as the deliberate and rather kind act of a young woman giving people a moment. I was thinking the same thing, Rose said. She was still looking at the Duke. In spring. I thought we might start in spring. We, the Duke said quietly. We, Rose confirmed. Outside, London moved through its winter evening, gray and lit, and entirely indifferent. Inside the south-facing sitting room, with the fire going and Mrs. Pratt's footsteps beginning below, that meant tea was coming, and Cecily warming her hands at the hearth with her diplomatic back turned, and the December light going gold at the edges of the windows. Inside, something that had been broken for 4 years was, quietly and without ceremony, whole. 1 year later, the ball at Ravenswood House was, by general consensus, the finest of the season. This was not an accident. The Duchess of Ravenswood had, it turned out, very specific opinions about flowers, about music, about the precise temperature at which a room full of 200 people became uncomfortable, and about the unforgivable social crime of serving mediocre food at an occasion that did not require it. The staff of Ravenswood House had adapted to these opinions with the speed of people who recognized, quickly, that they were dealing with someone who knew exactly what she wanted and was entirely prepared to be pleasant about insisting on it. Mrs. Pratt had come with her. This had not been negotiable. She stood now at the entrance to the ballroom, the same entrance, the same marble floor, the same soaring ceilings with their extravagant chandeliers, and watched the room fill. 1 year ago she had stood in the same doorway in a pale blue dress with simply pinned hair and no jewels, and the room had gone cold around her. Tonight she wore deep ivory silk, cut simply because she had never liked fuss, and at her throat her mother's pearls recovered, along with everything else, through Sir Edmund's meticulous and quietly triumphant legal work. Her hair was pinned with the silver hairpins that had been her mother's wedding gift, which she had last seen in Vivienne's dressing room, and which had been returned to her, along with an itemized list of every other recovered piece, in a document she had read 3 times before she could trust herself to set it down. The whispers had started again when she entered. But these were different whispers. She could hear the difference. 1 year had been enough to replace one story with another, the Ashworth girl who stole, with the Ashworth woman who had stood in this very room and watched the truth come out, and had danced with the Duke before anyone understood why, and had offered her hand to her stepsister while her stepmother was still in the room. The story that replaced the old one was, if anything, better than a simple exoneration. It had shape and drama and a satisfying architecture. And London, which ran on stories the way engines ran on coal, had taken to it with considerable enthusiasm. She did not especially enjoy being a story, but she understood it was preferable to the alternative. James appeared at her side. He had the gift, she had discovered over the past year, of arriving exactly when she needed him without appearing to have been watching for the moment, which she suspected required considerably more attention than he let on. "Lady Harcastle is here," he said quietly. "She has already told 3 people that she knew from the beginning." "She did know from the beginning," Rose said. "She simply didn't know that she knew." "I will not be the one to clarify the distinction." "Very wise." He offered his arm. She took it, and they moved into the room together, and the whispers moved with them and then around them and then past them, the way water moves around something solid and permanent, finding other directions. Cecily was near the fireplace, in pale gold silk that suited her far better than the pink she had been wearing a year ago. She had been in London for 6 months now, in a small set of rooms in Kensington that Rose had helped her find and furnish, on an income that had been arranged, quietly, through Sir Edmund, with no fanfare and no conditions, from the portion of the settlement that Rose had designated for her. Cecily had resisted this initially, with considerable feeling, and Rose had said simply, "Your father would have wanted you provided for, and so do I, and the matter is closed," and Cecily had looked at her for a long moment and then had stopped resisting. She was laughing now at something a young man beside her had said. She looked easy, unguarded, The expression of someone who has, slowly and with effort, found their footing in a life that had been significantly rearranged. Rose caught her eye across the room. Cecily raised her glass slightly. Rose raised hers in return. Lady Vivienne was not present. She had not been present at anything of consequence since the previous December, when Sir Edmund's letter had concluded the matter, and her own solicitor had advised her, in the clearest possible terms, that her social position in London was untenable. She had removed herself to the country, not the Ashworth house, which had been returned to Rose, but a modest property of her own in a county far enough away to be irrelevant. Rose did not wish her ill. She had examined that question carefully over several months and had arrived at an answer she trusted. She did not wish Vivienne ill. She did not wish her well particularly. She thought of her occasionally, and when she did, she thought of the look on her face in the ballroom, not the composed exit, not the magnificent controlled departure, but the moment just before, when something behind her eyes had been briefly visible. The moment that might, in a different life, have been a person. She had made her choices. Rose had made hers. That was sufficient. Sir Edmund Graves was also present. James had invited him, and he had accepted with the brevity of a man who did not waste words on acceptance letters, and had arrived precisely on time in a new blue coat that was marginally less gray than the previous one. He stood near the east wall with a glass of wine, and the expression of a man at an event he finds mildly baffling, but is attending out of genuine goodwill. Rose went to him first, before the evening properly began. She had wanted to. "Sir Edmund," she said. "Your Grace," he bowed slightly, correctly. She was still getting used to the title. "You look well." "I am well," she said, "because of you." He made a small dismissive gesture, the gesture of a man entirely uncomfortable with gratitude. "I did my job." "You did considerably more than your job," Rose said, "and I want you to know that I know that." Sir Edmund looked at his wine glass, then at the room, then briefly at her. "Your father," he said, "was a good man who deserved better than what happened to him. Making it right was," he paused, found the word, "satisfying." Another pause. The staff statements were the thing in the end, three of them, all consistent, all clear. "Your stepmother did not account for the fact that people remember what they witness even years later when someone finally asks." "No," Rose said, "she didn't." "She underestimated a great many things," Sir Edmund said, with the mild precision of a man delivering a verdict. "Including you." He raised his glass slightly. Rose raised hers. The orchestra struck up the first waltz of the evening. James found her at the edge of the floor, because he always found her at the edge of things. She had noticed this about him over the course of the year, the way he tracked where she was in a room without appearing to, the way he was simply there when there was a moment he sensed she might need him. She had told him once that she noticed this, and he had said, with perfect seriousness, that he had no idea what she was referring to, and she had laughed and not pressed the point. "The same waltz," she said, as he led her onto the floor. "I asked them to play it," he said. She looked up at him. "Did you?" "Sentiment," he said, in the tone he used when he was admitting to something he found slightly undignified. "I am told I am allowed it occasionally." "Who told you that?" "My wife." She smiled. He smiled. Around them the ballroom moved in its ancient, beautiful patterns, silk and candlelight, and the long strings pulling the melody through the room, 200 people turning and turning in the amber light. 1 year ago she had stood in the doorway of this room in a pale blue dress, and the word asterisk thief had moved through it like a current. Tonight she moved through the center of it in ivory silk and her mother's pearls. And the word that moved through the room around her was simply her name. "The Duchess." The Duchess of Ravenswood. She had thought, when Sir Edmund's letter arrived and she had sat at the writing desk with it in her hands, that the end of it would feel like something enormous, an arrival, a door opening into a room full of light. It did not feel like that, she had discovered. It felt quieter than that. It felt like waking up in the morning in a room that was hers, in a house that was safe, beside someone who had spent 7 months looking for her, and had not, once he had found her, looked away. It felt like Mrs. Pratt's footsteps below, and Cecily's letters arriving on Tuesdays and Sir Edmund's precise voice across a legal document, and the overgrown garden that was, as of last month, considerably less overgrown. It felt like standing on solid ground. It felt, finally and completely, like home. They had told the Duke she was a thief. He had known, from the very first moment, exactly what had been stolen, and he had spent a year giving it all back. Thank you for listening to the story all the way to the end. Please tell us which city you're watching from and what the story made you feel. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss new stories.